Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Mike Howell, and I'm going to introduce Nick Battia now to describe what we're going to do. But this is really a Q&A, a way of trying to understand the intricacies of Bitcoin from my perspective. In other words, a complete novice.
Wonderful, Michael. So we've done three parts. We recommend people go check out Teaching Bitcoin Parts 1, 2, and 3, or if you want it all in one place, we have that for you as well. We've taught Michael about Bitcoin and its cryptography mechanics, some of the features of the network, some of the history of Bitcoin, what Satoshi Nakamoto did. And now Michael is ready with a bunch of questions. So Michael, let's go with your follow-up questions now as Michael tries to really dig into the technical aspects of Bitcoin and the monetary aspects of Bitcoin.
Okay. So these are, let me just say up front, these are random thoughts, or certainly a random order of thoughts. And these are things that have just come up and I've scribbled them down as we've been going along. So the first question is, Bitcoin, as I understand it, certainly in the US, is taxed as an asset. So clearly that must impinge on its ability to be used in transactions.
So yes, Bitcoin right now, the IRS treats it as property. So that anytime you purchase something in Bitcoin, in theory, what you're doing is you're selling an asset in which you're subject to capital gains taxes, either short-term or long-term, and then you're making a purchase in dollars. So that's the way the IRS treats a Bitcoin transaction today. Now, there are motions in Congress to try to get a de minimis law passed for Bitcoin transactions in the $600 to $1,000 amount so that Bitcoin, day-to-day, hand-to-hand Bitcoin transactions can be treated without the capital gains tax implication. So I will say that first. Secondly, when we think about Bitcoin and its use case around the world, including in the United States, it's not necessarily for transactional purposes. It's to purchase and hold an asset. Just as gold is not necessarily used for a transactional currency in the US or in other countries, it can be and it is, but it doesn't mean that that's why people are using gold. People are holding gold as an asset because of its features as an asset to protect against their monetary situation or their even their political beliefs or their view of their specific government. So gold is held in that way. I think Bitcoin should be thought of as in a similar way. It can be used in transactions infinitely more than gold can because of its digital nature. But its tax treatment can prevent some of that activity. I believe over time, Michael, that will trend away and it will be legislated away. That the concept of Bitcoin de minimis transactions being exempt from capital gains, but also Bitcoin itself is going to need to have an entire legal framework in every nation. Basically, that it's either going to be treated as currency, treated as a commodity, virtual property, or something else entirely different, or legal tender for that matter. So you'll have a wide range. And my best answer to all the regulatory and tax questions is that Bitcoin has achieved its market value to date because of its circumstances. Good and bad. So I think that Bitcoin being pretty near its all-time high is evidence that whatever restrictive and oppressive regulatory and tax regimes Bitcoin operates in, it's still not enough to knock it down enough. And so that's the way I would answer that, Michael.
And if I did a follow-up by saying, what about if Bitcoin was part of a stable coin? Would that make any difference? How are stable coins taxed by the IRS?
Sure, that's a good question. So I know you have a question about Nigeria in a little bit. So let me just fast forward to that. Nigeria is a country that has an unstable currency regime, right? That's the premise. And that's the reason that Nigerians themselves are using stablecoins and they're using Bitcoin on the ground. Now, we've spoken to people on the ground in Nigeria and we've asked them, hey, is everyone using Bitcoin now? And the answer is no. Some people are using Bitcoin. Many of them are using it to store wealth. But for the on-the-ground economy, people are using stablecoins. And so as Bitcoin, let's say, researchers, and we're also enthusiasts, we hope that people are using Bitcoin on the ground, but they're using it for value storage. They're not using it for transactional purposes when compared to stablecoins. And that is interesting. So that's, I know that's not the question that you asked, but that addresses this idea of which one is more useful on the ground. Your questions around Gresham's Law, good money versus bad money, and how the two are used on the ground. It also goes back to, is Bitcoin an asset or is it money? I think they're almost all coming back to similar answers. Your question about dollar stablecoins and how they're taxed in the US, there's a regulatory framework that's been building out in the US for stablecoins, and they are not treated with a capital gains implication. And in my understanding, they're not treated in that same capital gains implication that the IRS treats Bitcoin. But I think every country needs to do more work on the regulatory clarity. I also believe, Michael, that the stablecoin regulations are being mixed up with CBDC efforts. So the central banks trying to have their own digital currencies that in theory might compete with stablecoins. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much confusion around the regulation around stablecoins and central bank digital currencies. But I believe that they're separate concepts from this exploration of Bitcoin as a hard asset and as a monetary hedge that you and I conduct a lot of research around. The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by Unchained, the undisputed leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults in which you own 2 of 3 keys and you gain a Bitcoin security partner. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage via Unchained's trading desk and eliminate all exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, where you can convert your existing 401ks or retirement accounts to Unchained, all while keeping control of your Bitcoin private keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to Unchained today. Go to unchained.com/TBL for $100 off when you sign up. Don't risk your Bitcoin security. Do you have Bitcoin private keys stored on paper? Make sure you convert those keys to titanium with Stampseed. Stampseed has this really cool DIY kit that allows you to hammer in your seed phrase into these small titanium plates that are fire resistant and damage resistant. This kit is designed by titanium metal workers that have been working in stamping metal for over 14 years, and your words are deeply stamped, not just a shallow dot. So make sure you check out stampseed.com today and use code TBL for 15% off of your order.
Okay. I mean, the question when you mentioned Gresham's Law was basically the observation. I mean, I brought Gresham's Law up, I think, at the beginning of our first episode, and saying that that's one of the monetary laws that one needs to understand and try and frame Gresham's Law with Bitcoin in it, or Bitcoin has to satisfy that. But one of the paradoxes of Gresham's Law is that actually, when you think about the world economy or a much bigger economic entity, it kind of works in reverse. And for those that are not familiar with Gresham's Law pretty much says that if you've got, let's say, a silver dollar, or let's say 2 silver dollars, one with a higher intrinsic value, has got a higher silver content than the other one, the higher intrinsic value will be taken out of circulation and used, not used, and the one that has got the lower silver content but the same face value will actually circulate. So in other words, what that's saying is bad money, the lower intrinsic value silver dollar, will drive the good money, the higher intrinsic value, out of circulation. Now, that's true within a jurisdiction where you have a face value. But when you have a situation where there's no jurisdiction or that jurisdiction is breaking down, then you tend to find the reverse of Gresham's law happens. And that's when you start to see, for example, in Eastern Europe, following the demise of communism, you start to see the monetary systems break down and a lot of these economies became dollarized. If you go back to the 1990s, with Mexico or Latin America with very high inflation rates, those economies dollarized, etc. Now, we could actually envision this occurring on a global scale. And if you go back to something I was writing about maybe a few years ago in the book Capital Wars about how the world monetary system could evolve, I used the analogy there about the sort of 1984 model of George Orwell, where you had three big regions, Oceania, East Asia and Eurasia. And what you can envision today is if that world actually transpires, what you get, for example, in America and maybe Britain, i.e. Airstrip 1, or so it was called, you get the dollar circulating. You may get the Chinese yuan circulating in East Asia, for example, ultimately. But then how do you actually transact either between these regions, or how do you transact in other territories like India or whatever? What currency do you use? And then you can see a case for saying that it might not be the dollar or the yuan. It may be some hybrid, a gold-based currency or a gold plus Bitcoin-based currency. And that way you can actually see these monetary laws being fulfilled. And in that case, essentially, good money will drive out bad. And between regions, you start to see this hybrid emerging. So that, I'm not saying I'm answering my own question, but those are my thoughts in that regard.
So here's the way that I see Bitcoin interacting with the dollar over the next decade, because it's very hard. I mean, we can try to project, but it's very difficult to think multiple decades out. I see Bitcoin keeping its role as a decentralized digital asset that is starting to chip away from other asset classes such as gold or real estate. So a young person today in the United States that comes into a new signing bonus is more likely to purchase some Bitcoin with that new money versus buy a property. They're more likely to buy stocks or buy Bitcoin than they are to buy, let's say, gold or real estate. A young person in the United States, just based on some of the statistics that we're seeing about Bitcoin ownership in the US. So if that is the case, then Bitcoin is fulfilling this role of digital gold, digital real estate at the margin, and doesn't need to be the transactional, global transactional currency that people might want Bitcoin to become. And this is the problem I have with a lot of the narratives around the death of the dollar, as well as hyper-Bitcoinization. These are both concepts that have been popular in Bitcoin for many years, as one of the reasons to buy Bitcoin is that the dollar is under some grand degradation. And I think you and I would agree there, mm-hmm. that over time, the dollar is seeing a significant degradation against real assets. That is a fact. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that the dollar is degrading versus global currencies. Exactly. It's not. It's the opposite. It also doesn't mean that the dollar is becoming less used as a transactional or credit-based currency. Because mm-hmm. you and I know it's not just about transactional currency, the dollar. It's about the credit system. It's about mm-hmm. the bond market. That's what makes the dollar network so entrenched. So yeah, the dollar exactly. to me isn't going anywhere, and it's not going to be hybridized with anything else, in my opinion. It's just going to have this very strong global network effect that isn't going anywhere. The Chinese yuan might rise if we see more convertibility, more transparency on the exchange rate, more international extension of Chinese yuan credit, because we know that international extension of dollar credit via the euro dollar system is something that's been going on since the 1950s at the very minimum, as the dollar entrenches itself around the world. So in my opinion, and I started the Bitcoin layer to narrate this transition of Bitcoin becoming more centric to the world system, I just don't believe that Bitcoin being a global transactional currency and dominating that sphere is part of its next 10 to 20 year destiny.
Right.
It's more as an asset. And if you think about young people coming into hard-earned money all around the world, what is the asset they go to store that wealth? Is it going to be gold, a basket of international equities, Bitcoin, or some mix of these three? And I would suggest that the young generation is moving into Bitcoin to the point that its market cap will grow very naturally and trend toward gold, which is still a 15x gain from here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Putting Bitcoin easily at $1 million US. And I just think that's a natural trend without having to go into how is Bitcoin going to be used in the global geopolitical game. I think it's more of a mom and pop, but not even the mom and pop. It's the young man, the young woman around the world that are going to be making this prophecy about Bitcoin that it's digital gold come true.
Okay, fair point. Okay, so on that basis, moving on to the third question, which is, if I want to buy Bitcoin and I'm not familiar with it, how do I do it? Now, my experience so far, just for the record, is that I've been buying ETFs over the last 2 or 3 years, not the actual physical coin or the notional coin. So lead us through that. How does one do it if you use Coinbase or whatever the exchange?
Sure. So it's going to vary depending on your jurisdiction, but every single major jurisdiction has cryptocurrency exchanges that are reputable. And countries like the United States have companies that are financial services providers in which it's not even their mission to provide a buying and selling platform, but it's their mission to be your Bitcoin bank. So Unchained, for example, the sponsor of our channel, is a financial services provider that has a trading desk, but their primary offering is a multi-signature wallet in which you own 2 of 3 of the keys. So Unchained doesn't have the power to spend your Bitcoin, but they can help you and assist you in the management of your storage,
mm-hmm,
and basically be your bank. And so I think there are more and more services like this, that they're not just exchanges. But to answer your question more plainly, the way to do it is you start an account, you get verified because all the reputable exchanges have know your customer and anti-money laundering laws that they have to follow in these major jurisdictions, including the US and the UK. You wire US dollars to your new exchange account, assuming that your own bank will let you send that wire. There have been challenges all across the world on that front as well. In the US, it's easier now than it probably ever was, but you still see people complaining that my bank blocked my deposit to a cryptocurrency exchange. And then you go onto the platform and you're looking for BTC, because remember, there's only one Bitcoin. that has this network of nodes that are verifying the transaction. So you want to make sure that you're buying BTC, not any other ticker, right? Because most of these exchanges offer a bunch of products. Mm-hmm. And you're going to either, just like any other exchange, you're going to put in a market order or a limit order, the amount. And once you're filled on your transaction, now on your exchange, you're going to have a balance. Right. So let's say you bought half a Bitcoin. It's going to say 0.50000 Bitcoin on your screen. You can withdraw that balance to your own wallet. So let me go. So, Michael,
so
why don't
I fractionalize that? That's important.
Okay. Bitcoin is divisible in the, remember we talked about these nodes, their software implementations. These Bitcoin software implementations have, part of the code is that each one Bitcoin is divisible to 100 million subunits.
Right.
So that's why you hear the term sat to describe Satoshi. It's a single, it's 1/100 millionth of a Bitcoin. And so, you know, exchanges might have minimum thresholds, but yes, you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin, and then you have two choices. You can keep it on the exchange can go away and you'll lose your Bitcoin because these are mostly not insured products.
Right.
Or you can withdraw, and because it's a hopefully a reputable Bitcoin exchange, the ability to use the blockchain is, the power is with you. So you can click withdraw. And if you have a dollar balance, it'll say, you know, withdraw USD or GBP, and or it can say withdraw cryptocurrency, withdraw BTC. You can withdraw BTC. So instead of asking you for a bank account, it's going to ask you for what? A receive address.
Right.
So that receive address that you give the exchange needs to be one that you have generated from your own secure wallet situation, right? So if you would need, in that situation, you would need your own wallet. You would need to have created your own private key, and that wallet will provide the address, the shareable address. You provide that address to your cryptocurrency exchange. You send a transaction, you withdraw your BTC to that address. And then that address, that transaction will go into the mempool. Remember the suspense account. Mm-hmm. You will wait for a miner to grab that transaction, put it in a block and make it onto the blockchain. And only when that transaction has made it into a block will your own wallet show you that, yes, I now have custody of this 0.5 Bitcoin. And it'll be a little less because you've paid a fee. You know, a mining fee or an exchange fee to withdraw or whatever the situation is. Now, people can buy Bitcoin peer-to-peer, so I can literally find a person on the street, hand them paper money, and show my QR code address and have them send me Bitcoin, and then I'll wait to see, okay, this is a pending transaction or it's settled. Now onto the blockchain, and that's a peer-to-peer transaction, just like you can go into a coin shop, set some paper notes on the table, and take a gold coin in your pocket and walk away. So a cryptocurrency exchange is essentially like any other financial exchange, but the ability to take custody of the asset is seemingly infinitely more than, let's say, if you were to have a brokerage account, how would you withdraw those equity shares to your own custody?
Yeah.
It's not possible. It's not feasible because that's not how the system works.
Okay. So two follow-up questions on that. So the wallet that I create, okay, I mean, that's a straightforward process, presumably, to create a wallet, but that presumably sits on my computer, or it could sit in a USB stick. Correct?
Yes. So there are several types of wallets, Michael. There are hardware wallets. There are computer-based wallets, smartphone-based wallets. And there are even paper wallets, which, if you think about what a Bitcoin address is and what a Bitcoin wallet is, a Bitcoin wallet is a term that's used to describe the collection of these private keys. So each one of your keys is a number. So your wallet is basically a storage of a number storage. So number storage can happen, like you said, on a USB stick. They're called hardware wallets because there are hardware manufacturers that are making these devices. But you can, if you have, I would suggest, if you want to do this yourself, you take a computer offline completely. So either you purchase or use an old computer, you strip it of any internet connectivity.
Yeah.
And you put software on it, a wallet software, a Bitcoin node software to generate your own private keys, convert them into addresses, and then take the addresses off the computer into the public environment. You can do that on an offline computer. I wouldn't suggest you ever do it on an online computer because that is going to make you subject to hacking, right? You want to make sure that your keys are kept safe and offline to the best. So you can generate them in any way, any one of these ways. The paper wallet is a great example because it really allows you to grasp that this is just math, and you can have an offline computer and an offline printer generate a private key and print it out.
Right. Okay. If I store it on a hard disk and the hard disk fails, I've got a problem. If I've got it on my computer or my hard disk and there's a fire or a theft, I've lost it. So these are obviously issues, physical issues. Now the other question, or the other associated question, is what about if you get a custodian? And I note the fact that Bank of New York Mellon, I believe, has just been approved as a custodian. That must, given the reputation of Bank of New York Mellon as longstanding custodians, I mean, that must be quite significant, yeah?
Absolutely. So let me say a few things here. Number one, I want to just mention our second sponsor, Stampseed, which is a company that designs these titanium plates and heavy-duty hammer and letter stamps so that you can physically stamp your private key. It's called a seed phrase. We didn't get into the efficiency around private key storage, but basically now, as long as you can store 12 or 24 words, you can have control over an entire wallet and an infinite string of private keys and all of that. So companies are developing ways to protect the private keys from digital failure, right? So that's definitely one thing. Your question about custody, Bank of New York, Mellon entering the game. Yes, this is a big deal, Michael, but I would say that all of these news items that Mellon is going to get have a custody product. They've dropped Mellon. It's Bank of New York now. I still keep saying Mellon. The ETFs that got approved, right? Fidelity and BlackRock entering the game in 2024 in the US, these are not new stories. These stories have been with us for several years, but the market has... You know how markets have a funny way of pricing things in and when they do and how they do. So I believe all of this news is baked into the Bitcoin price.
Okay.
And that the Bitcoin today at $1 trillion market cap represents an advanced institutionalization of Bitcoin. And to take it to the next level, you need more users. But the tools... The laws, the companies, the financial behemoths, they're all here. They've all come to play. And we knew Fidelity was mining in 2013. So they've been experimenting with this technology with their MIT friends in Boston for a decade. Mm. And that was something that attracted me to Bitcoin. One of the things that attracted me to Bitcoin in 2016, I was like, you know, I've grown up looking at Fidelity as this powerhouse in brokerage that just gets it when it comes to finance.
Yeah.
So, yep.
Okay, I mean that leads me on to a couple of other points. I mean, one is we mentioned the or you mentioned the public private key. So just so I've got my I'm fully on board with understanding this. As I understand it, a public key is like your house number and street name, right? And your private key is maybe the code for your burglar alarm system. That's the correct analogy.
Okay, so it's pretty close. And let's just make it as technical as we can, but keep it simple also. So a private, the string of characters that we use to share with others to receive Bitcoin is called an address. And to get
it's from like a computer address.
Yes. To get from a private key to an address, it actually goes through two different cryptographic hash functions. So it goes from a private key to a public key, and then a public key to an address. Okay. So that two-step cryptographic hash allows us to do things with the public key that basically, remember we talked about how we can generate private keys in an offline environment? But if you want to generate private keys in an offline environment, but then still be able to receive Bitcoin with new fresh addresses all the time, you can actually take your public key into an online environment and then hash that to generate addresses and still never have the private key in an online environment. So anyway, this is a technical thing that I wanted to specify, that from a private key to an address, it goes through a public key also. So there's two steps there. And that makes Bitcoin, honestly, it makes it more usable. Now, your analogy about the house address, I would say it's good, but it's not good enough because people could still, in theory, just maybe open your mailbox, right? So to a better one is email, mm-hmm. right? So email addresses are shareable, but the emails are not readable without your password to your login. And it's more – it's an even better analogy for this other reason, Michael, which is that email, and we can throw this slide. I'll have our editors throw this slide up here with our SMTP versus Bitcoin comparison. So simple mail transfer protocol is the protocol, but I could be using Gmail. You could be using Microsoft Outlook. We're still using SMTP because it understands that I will share an address with you. You will be able to send data to me. And with my password, only with my password and address combination via the SMTP protocol can I access the messages that are being sent. So really, it's email is a much better one.
Okay,
but your burglar alarm and house address metaphor is absolutely on the right track, in which you're the only one that should know the code to your right. house alarm, right?
Right?
But everybody can know your address and where you live and where your things are held.
Okay, got it. Right, okay. Now, this is now a dumb question, but it's one that, you know, I still bother about. And that is that if you look at how the network in Bitcoin is growing and the number of transactions that are growing and the number of nodes, etc., whatever, surely the computational task of holding all this information is just sort of, you know, is mind-bogglingly large. I mean, how is that going to be possible as the network grows exponentially?
It's an excellent question. Now, there are a few ways to discuss this. Number one, the data burden of storing the entire blockchain and all transactions is still accomplished by a high quality retail facing laptop today. It's not capable, you're not able to do it on one of these mm-hmm. very well right now. Because there's too much computing that needs to be done all the time to verify. Remember, if blocks are being propagated, as a node, I have to be able to download these blocks and verify them at all times. So there's a computational hurdle to that. It is easily done, though, through a laptop. So any mom and pop business that wants a full economic node in their storefront, let's say, they can do that. And I think that Bitcoin developers are working extremely hard to make the computational burden less and less and less intensive on the individual every day. So that's one thing I would say. Second thing is that if you want to be a Bitcoin holder, Michael, if you want to be someone that keeps Bitcoin in cold storage, offline, there is no reason that you need to be performing verification on every subsequent transaction all the time. If you are using Bitcoin all the time, you should have a situation in which you can check the blockchain yourself and reference the blockchain yourself, meaning you are a node operator. And so any exchange, you can imagine any exchange or Bitcoin company that is dealing in Bitcoin transactions is running their own node. And those companies that are running their own nodes are never going to have some large computational burden to verifying transactions. They're not mining Bitcoin. Remember, the difference in mining Bitcoin versus just the verification of new blocks through your node, it's infinitesimal, right? And so now you think about the average person. So let's now put our feet into the shoes of the average person in, let's pick South America, that has about $1,000 worth of Bitcoin on his or her phone and is using that as a wallet, a walk-around wallet. Let's even use Argentina, because we know that in Argentina, Bitcoin is used on the ground and has a deep history there with its hyperinflationary currency. Now, let's say that that person with a $1,000 wallet also has $50,000 worth of Bitcoin. So let's say 1.0 Bitcoin in a cold storage wallet kept in some secret place, and hopefully not in a bank vault, because, you know, it's these things are going potentially subject to seizure. So they have 1.0 Bitcoin hidden, buried somewhere on their property, and they have a smartphone wallet with 0.01 Bitcoin. So that would put it like $650 worth today. And they're using a smartphone wallet. And they go to the store, they buy groceries, they go to their own shop, and they receive revenue through Bitcoin all on their smartphone wallet. Then maybe they have made a couple $1,000s, they go home and they send some of that money, some of that Bitcoin back to their cold storage and top down their wallet a little bit, their smartphone wallet. Then they go back outside the next day and they transact in Bitcoin with their smartphone wallet. That smartphone wallet, Michael, does not need a node. That individual does not need a node. And why? Because that smartphone wallet company that the person has chosen is hopefully a reputable company, is looking back to their own nodes. And you can even assign which nodes you want your own smartphone walk-around wallet to look back. So if you want your own node at home, you can still have it on, paired to your smartphone wallet. Or if you don't want that computational burden, you have to engage in some level of trust. But hopefully you're using a software that you've done some due diligence on, that you can verify that the code is open source, that the keys are actually located on your device and not in an offline environment or not on the server of the wallet company, right? Because remember, if you have your smartphone wallet, the your seed phrase, your private key numbers are on the phone. They're on the in the memory of the phone.
Right.
But Apple is designing, you know, their phones in a way where the keys to your wallet are stored in a place that the other apps can't access.
Right. Right. We hope.
We hope. Now, and that's why you know, you're not supposed to hold your keys on a smartphone if you want full security. It's not secure enough.
Right.
So there's all levels. There's all that. What's fascinating, Michael, is how many companies have blossomed up around Bitcoin: storage, wallets, custody, shared custody, know your customer custody, not non-know your customer custody, peer-to-peer exchanges, online international exchanges, offshore exchanges, domestic regulated exchanges. So many different companies around the world. They're all competing. They're all growing, and it's amazing to watch. And you don't see that energy around any other cryptocurrency. It just doesn't exist, because why would you build long-term products around coins that might die in 3 years? You just wouldn't make the investment.
Sure. Sure. Good point. Okay. Right. Okay. Moving on to another question. There's 21 million, or there's a 21 million ceiling on Bitcoin, but what's the attrition rate of Bitcoin, in the sense that what we know is, I mean, there's well publicized stories about people that have lost their private keys or whatever. So is that 21 million, you know, in reality nearer 18 million or 19 million or whatever the number may be? So actually the total or the maximum supply of Bitcoin is actually smaller than people think. And there must also be instances where, you know, people lose their private keys, people pass away, they don't pass their information on to somebody else. So there must be some, you know, some attrition rate every year. So that 18 million or 19 million is itself getting smaller. Any clues on that?
Okay. It's an excellent question. And I should say straight off the bat, we don't know how many, right? There's no way to know. Now, there are estimates that up to 30% of Bitcoin could be lost forever. But there's no way to know how many Bitcoin are sleeping and how many have been lost, right? All we know is when they move on the blockchain. And so we know that several million have been sleeping for over 10 years, right? It implies that a slice of those are lost forever. We just don't know. Now, one important statistic that you should know about Bitcoin is that 10.5 million of the 21 million, so 50% of the supply, was awarded in the first 210,000 blocks, because the block reward, the starting block reward, was 50. So 50 times 210,000 is 10.5 million. The first halving was in 2012.
Right.
Now, that means that 5+ million Bitcoin were mined when Bitcoin wasn't worth essentially anything. Mm-hmm. When it was worth about as much as, I don't even want to say a digital collectible, because that has its own its own connotations now. But basically, it didn't have any street value until 2011.
Right.
And even then, it didn't have any true mainstream tangible value until 2013. The first time it hit $1,000 and the market cap hit $15 billion or so. I shouldn't even say that. $10 billion or so. Kind of, okay, Bitcoin has arrived on the scene of a material asset now at $10 billion. But that wasn't until 2013. And so, and you know, I don't have the exact numbers there, but I'm just suggesting here that several million Bitcoin were produced by miners on laptops when it wasn't worth anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we can presume a lot of that Bitcoin is lost forever.
Right.
So your number around 18 million as what is probably closer to the ceiling of Bitcoin with all the lost coins over the years might be fair. Okay, that's a little in the 10 to 15% range.
Mm-hmm.
So call it 10 to 30%. Call it somewhere between 15 and 18 million coins. People, again, there's no way I can know. So I'm not going to make some claim that we know how many coins are lost and how many are sleeping. Okay. But the blockchain allows us to observe the age of every single coin. We also know that approximately 1 million coins are Satoshi mined, and those have never moved.
Right.
So we know probably never more than 20 million are a non-sleeping supply. But again, I just believe it's baked into the price because markets have known all of these things for a very long time, and the marginal demand and supply is what sets the price always. And if there's some sudden scarcity in the future because we thought that sleeping coins would wake up because of a new higher price for profit takers to wake up and say, dust off that old laptop, or hopefully dust off that piece of paper with the private key on it and sweep it into an exchange account and sell it for fiat currency, withdraw that currency, pay a capital gains tax, and still be satisfied with the whole transaction. Those types of transactions, they happen every time Bitcoin experiences one of its really hyper moves
right
to the upside. And you see old coins come out of dormancy. And right. We are right. able to see every single one of these things happen on the blockchain, the Bitcoin layer. We track on-chain data. We're tracking metrics that we like to tell us information about the age of coins because it demonstrates behavior, and we can right. use behavior to assist us in yeah. analyzing a market.
Yeah. Now, I'm a big believer that prices are determined at the margin, that's for sure. But one of the problems with financial analysis, as we know it, is that it assumes the investment community is fixed. In other words, it assumes that the football stadium is already full and there are no new entrants coming in. And those new entrants are not discounting that information in all likelihood. So they're basically new to the game. So I think all these facts are actually important because, you know, what we know is there's a ceiling on supply of Bitcoin. It's 21 million, but in actual fact, reality is not 21 million. It's lower than that. So this is all information which actually builds the case or a more compelling case. So that brings me on to the last question or the last series of questions I had, which is really about metrics. What should people be looking at to actually gauge or analyze more rigorously Bitcoin? And I'm, you know, thinking here about, I mean, you correct me, but my feeling would be you look at things like mining costs, the effect of halving, the growth of nodes, for example, how long people are actually holding, the holding period for Bitcoin. These are things which are actually extremely relevant for understanding the future, the effective supply.
Yes, that's an excellent question. So the first thing that people need to do is subscribe to the bitcoinlayer.com/subscribe so you can follow along what we're doing because we're analyzing, but we're also trying to teach you how to analyze these markets. Within Bitcoin, we have all of this data. We have to do our best to filter through what is helping us with Bitcoin stage in the cycle and what's not. So you mentioned halvings. Let's start there. We had a halving in 2012 and a parabolic price move in 2013. A halving in 2016, a move from sub 1,000 in late 2016 to 20,000 2017. You had a halving in 2020 and Bitcoin's price going from 3,000 in early 2020 to 70,000 in 2021. You had a halving in 2024 this year. Bitcoin was below 30,000 at the beginning of this year, and it has doubled since then, and we believe we're on the cusp of another one of those halving plus 1 year price moves. So people ask all the time, is Bitcoin's price still tied to halvings? And my answer is that if it's three for three, who are we to say that it's not related? It mm-hmm. just seems completely the opposite of using common sense and your eyeballs and your calculators and your calendars. And so I guess we'll know by next year if we're four for four on this halving thing. But I think it's so important, we shouldn't ignore. Now you overlay halving events with our favorite on-chain metric, which is realized price. And a derivative of realized price is the ratio of market price to realized price. Realized price, Michael, is the sum of all Bitcoin on-chain transactions at their dollar price. So you can think of it as the cold storage price, right? We buy Bitcoin on the exchange, but when you send it to yourself, you strike that price, and that is your realized value in Bitcoin. It's the dollar value at which you took custody.
Right.
So we have this cold storage price and we have market price. The ratio between the two, it is, guess what? It's cyclical, and it lines up with these halving events, these 2013, 2017, and 2021 price rises. And you see the market value ratio to the realized value increase to levels at 4x, 5x, 6x. What that means in today's prices is that today's realized price, Michael, is around $31,000. The last peak in MVRV was 4x. Yes. That would put the Bitcoin price today at $125,000. That would be expensive Bitcoin. Today we're at an MVRV of 2, which is not expensive. It's not cheap though. Mm-hmm. And it's almost in this fair value range historically. Because an MVRV closer to 1 is a very discounted price historically. When your cold storage price is equal to the market price, it means, hey, all the profit taking is done.
Right.
All the profit taking is done. And when MVRV is climbing, and again, it's cyclical, but when it does, you see a lack of willingness to take profits.
So and that's really a measure of the stored up capital gain.
It's 100%. That's what it is. And almost every Bitcoin on-chain metric is trying to measure this stored capital gain, this unrealized profit loss. You know, they all describe the same thing. Mm-hmm. The capital gain, the unrealized profit and loss, the realized price versus the market price, they are all describing what is the profitability of these positions for people that have taken it into custody.
Right.
Because again, about your marginal supply comment and the limited supply, Bitcoin holders understand this. So they are the ones in theory that are squeezing the price every halving cycle. They're the ones that are not putting the coins on exchange. They're the ones that are increasing the age. Mm-hmm. Now, we cover all of this at the Bitcoin layer. We don't think there's anybody quite like us that's doing both an interest rate forward, repo markets and money markets forward global macro analysis overlaid with a Bitcoin native analysis to look at everything from on-chain metrics to mining. Now, your question about mining costs is very relevant, but it can't be answered with any simple answer because your mining cost is going to be determined by your electricity price. And so it's what's making Bitcoin mining a global energy arbitrage more than anything. So it almost doesn't have anything to do with, I believe, anymore determining Bitcoin's marginal price, because the mining is coming from so many different mining. I shouldn't say that. Okay, miners are the ones that secure new Bitcoin, and it's their prerogative to sell or to hold it. Most publicly, miners are selling to pay for their power bills. And that is part of the marginal, that's just part of the marginal price. So I shouldn't say that miners don't have anything to do with setting the marginal price. That's far from the truth. What I'm trying to say here is that the price of miners that they pay for electricity is so widely varied now around the world that I don't think we can say, oh, Bitcoin is worth this much today because it takes this much to mine it, in the way that we can say, we know it costs about somewhere between $1,000 and $2,000 to pull gold out of the ground, and we can sell it for $2,600 today and secure our margin. So I don't think there's a great pure mining cost, but there are mining cost indices that average these electricity prices around the world and combine it, of course, with the difficulty level, which changes all the time because that affects how easy or difficult it is to find a hash lower than the target and then win the block. So it's hard to say
whether, you know, Bitcoin's price should be positively or negatively related to energy prices. I mean, there's a case for both, isn't there?
Because there is no one energy price, and most of Bitcoin is being done renewable. I mean, the vast majority of Bitcoin mining is being done renewably, and it is also more and more being done in a stranded energy capacity, in which there's excess energy that would go waste, but now it's being used by Bitcoin miners. And so the marginal cost of stranded energy is close to zero.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
So if you come on to the sort of last point I raised, which is this business about thinking of Bitcoin's development in terms of two legs. One is, I mean, I've described it before as being the intensive margin where an individual is holding more and more Bitcoin, and the extensive margin where you've got more and more holders of Bitcoin. Okay, those two dimensions. And recognizing that the extensive margin, the numbers of people using Bitcoin, is developing like an S-shaped growth curve, like the takeoff of any technology, be it mobile phones, Wi-Fi or whatever, or automobiles or whatever. And then you've got this intensive margin, which is, as I say, moving maybe more linearly, but certainly nothing like as rapidly. Now, that S-shaped growth curve is going to depend on the growth of the nodes in the system, presumably, as the network builds out. So you're looking for that. And that presumably must be connected with the turnover or the velocity of Bitcoin. In other words, that if everyone sits on their Bitcoin and doesn't trade it or doesn't move it, then you can't get the growth of nodes, can you? Well, those nodes are going to be slower to grow.
Yes, so I would.
So there must be some connection there. So actually, understanding the metric of the holding period of Bitcoin is a critical element in understanding the development. So presumably, if you've got more rapid turnover, you're going to see a much stronger price, Bitcoin price.
So that's an excellent observation. The more rapid turnover of Bitcoin when the market price is higher than that cold storage price will drive the stored value of Bitcoin higher. It'll drive the realized price higher, mathematically so, because if a transaction occurs today at today's market price, it physically drags the realized price up because you have an old price that that coin has struck at in the realized price. Now it's a new price. So the realized price rises. So with more turnover, realized price goes up, and it supports the stored value of Bitcoin. That supports the valuation of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. In our opinion, it's what underpins the value is the very fact that capital is stored in this other asset. That's what gives it the value. So your holding period comment is it's a very excellent observation. Because it's only when the turnover speeds up that realized price follows. Mm-hmm. But counterintuitively, some of it happens toward the end of profit taking. Mm-hmm. So even though realized price is still going up, the market price has advanced to such a multiple that it actually creates then the back half of the cycle,
right?
Or the bear markets. And Bitcoin goes through very intense bear markets. It's part of its character as an asset class. And these bear markets do basically precede the halving events because of this cyclicality that we've been discussing. I want to mention also that we have data, and we'll put this chart up as well, that every investor on average that holds Bitcoin for 3.5 years or more is in a profit. So that's basically the threshold for the cycle. Mm-hmm. So if you can weather the 3.5 to 4 year period, mm-hmm. there's no point in time from Bitcoin's history that you would be underwater on your fiat marked position.
Right.
And again, this 3.5 years, we've done the work along with Unchained. It's part of their report and their original HODL waves chart that demonstrates this behavior. I think you would be fascinated by HODL waves, Michael, maybe for next time. But what we see with these waves is that Bitcoin holders know it will only take them 3.5 years to weather any storm, which shrinks the marginal supply heading into these post-halving bull cycles. And it accentuates the bull markets.
I'm surprised it's as long as that, actually, the drawdown period.
The drawdown periods can be extended and brutal. For example, the COVID low in 2020 took Bitcoin all the way down to 3,000.
Right.
But in 2017, when Bitcoin crashed from 20 back all the way down to 3, it got to 3 right at the beginning of 2018. And it had reached over, 12,000 at some point during, I believe, 2019. And then came all the way back down to tag the lows. So the bear markets in Bitcoin are really trying and testing for those holders. But they do empirically understand that they have this grace period of 3.5 years if they can hold through it. And this should make 2025 and a breakout to new all-time highs for Bitcoin extremely fascinating.
Absolutely. Great. Now, Nick, I've exhausted all my questions. So I'm now an expert.
You are. Welcome to the Bitcoin Orange Pill Club. And we're excited to hear where your research goes from here. Michael Howell, thank you so much for joining us for this incredible 4-part series in which I get to teach you Bitcoin and hear your questions and learn from you as well about monetary concepts. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike.
Well, thanks for your patience. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
With Michael Howell, I'm Nick Bhatia, the Bitcoin Layer. We'll catch you guys next time.